Blessings, I'm your host, Keir Knoll, and welcome to The Red Path. And welcome to this, part two of our discussion with Steve Martin, visual artist, farmer, wildcrafter, builder, teacher, writer, and visionary. In part one, we discussed spiritual aspects of Stephen's indigenous knowledge. Now we continue our conversation and discuss some of the practical discoveries made by Stephen in co-creating the Madawaska Forest Garden.
Around the turn of the century, there was a big debate about how soil causes plants to grow. And the debate was about whether there was soil chemistry or soil biology. Needless to say, the biologists lost, and we ended up with our three factors for growth, potassium, nitrogen, and phosphorus. And if you get those three in a fertilizer, you can get things to grow. And of course, we're seeing the results of that, and we're kind of returning to soil biology from a scientific standpoint. Of course, indigenous methods never left that.
Yeah. I did these interviews with elders when I was doing my MA on traditional land use. And lots of these people were part of the Green Revolution. They lived through it. So they saw how their grandfather and how their father farmed. And then they went away to war, Second World War. And then when they came back, there was these test farms that the government had set up. And of course, what they did is they retooled everything. So they retooled all the machinery that was making tanks into making tractors. They retooled the factories that were making bombs into making fertilizers. So the war on the earth started then, and it's still going on, right? The whole military connection to agriculture started then in a big way. And what these people told me is that back in their grandfather's day, you cut up a couple potatoes. You know how you cut them up so there's one eye for each piece?
Yes, yes, I remember that.
Potato, and you let the outside part dry, and you stick them in a mound of soil. And this miraculous thing happens if the soil is living, which is that that one little chunk of a potato produces about three or four potatoes. And so you put a few of those chunks in a mound, and you get a whole mound full of potatoes, right? Like a half a bag of potatoes just from one mound. And what he saw was that the first couple years that they used the chemical fertilizer and the organic was still alive, those 3 billion different microbial beings that live in the soil were still alive, they got double the production. And so everyone went, whoa, these chemicals are great, right? And then they stopped using manure. They stopped using the horse for plowing, right? So they didn't have a need for horses anymore. They maybe kept one or two around for pulling logs in the winter or something, but they let all the plows go. They bought tractors. And then they stopped putting manure in the soil at all, and they just used chemicals. And then around the fifth year, they started to notice, fourth or fifth year, that it was maybe only half as much potatoes. So instead of 20, you're just getting 10. And another few years passed, they were only getting half as much again. Another couple years passed, they were only getting two potatoes from a mound because the whole biotic community is so broken down that those chemicals have nothing to feed. And of course, it's not the chemicals that the plants are necessarily feeding on. It's what the chemicals are feeding all those little beings in the soil that are working with the roots, you know, in a synergistic way and in a way that's evolved over billions of years. You're losing all that. So this is the whole thing. And then you have to just use more chemicals, right? And pump that whole thing up. And so that whole thing's been going on for like 70 years now. And that's why, like in my area here, which is primarily a sand alluvial till, which is to say it's not clay soil, it's completely sapped of all its nutrients, and so all the fields are totally exhausted, and nobody makes a living from farming anymore. And the only way that you can turn that around is to start bringing in tons and tons, literally, of organic material and laying it down or plowing it in or, you know, however method you do it. If you start bringing enough back in, then the land starts coming back, you know?
Yeah.
But this, the Madawaska Forest Garden was kind of based on this whole premise that what if we took a fairly pristine forest plot and we replicated indigenous agriculture, which is they never plowed anything. They never turned the soil upside down. They never pulled the stumps out. They never pulled the rocks out. And all of these things, of course, are part of that biotic community that's feeding the soil. And sure enough, I proved it, that I could grow these tremendous trees, tremendous vegetables. The taste was unbelievable from the forest soil. But you just do it so long as it would happen in a natural succession. And what you see in a forest clearing, which the whole thing is kind of based on, and I believe the indigenous knowledge is based on too, is that it comes in, herbs come in first. The herbs and the grasses are the first healers. And then there's other waves of things, right? The vines come in maybe 3 or 5 years later, the small trees and shrubs, and then the bigger, you know, fruit trees, things like cherry and plum and wild fruit like that. And then the nut trees and the maples and the hickories and all these hardwoods, big hardwoods. And holy smokes, man. So this site now is 22 years old. There are trees that are 50 feet tall. And if you tried growing a tree out in these exhausted fields, like where my farm is, well, it'd be about 10 feet tall in the same amount of time. And that's with full sun, you know? So it's just incredible how we missed the boat, you know? And I really hope the word of the Madawaska Forest Garden kind of gets out, because it basically blows permaculture and all these things out of the water, because suddenly you realize that you don't actually have to manipulate the land so much to work with it. You just have to pay attention to the natural synergies and the natural ways that it reproduces and revitalizes itself. And then, of course, you know, I learned this from the Mayan people up in Chiapas, Lacandon people. And then what they would do is after about 5 years of growing annuals and stuff, they just leave the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the earth can come back in and heal the land, but that biotic community, those trophic layers in the soil are not lost, you know? And you pocket plant. So when you're planting something, you make a hole, you put the seed in, and that's it. You don't have to turn everything upside down and freaking wreck everything just for, you know, this one little seed that you're putting in that doesn't even really need those nutrients from the giant kill off of your plowing, you know.
When you destroy the soil, you're breaking up the hyphae. You're breaking up a whole living community in there when you till.
Oh yeah, devastation, genocide, right?
Yeah, there was something interesting.
I love talking about this stuff because it's like, you know, that whole thing that in one handful of good soil, there's more living beings than all the humans on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing is just trying to make those beings happy. Permaculture and certain ways of, you know, lasagna gardening or whatever, where you're layering stuff is really mimicking nature. And that part of it is dead on the money, you know.
There's something that you had mentioned about planting a tree and digging out a big hole for it and putting rich soil in that hole. And you said ultimately doing it that way is self-defeating. Could you expand on that a little?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like us in the apartment building, right? If we make things all cushy-cushy for ourselves, then there's no reason to go outside. And so same thing when you're planting a tree. If you remove all the obstacles from the hole, all the rotting material, you know, you make this beautifully suited to fit the exact, you know, qualities that this tree needs or whatever. It's like a pot. The roots will all just grow around in that, and it will actually become root bound. And then in becoming root bound, and in the particularly in the high levels of nitrogen, which form nitrates in the plant, those nitrates attract bugs. And so you've made this essentially this kind of time bomb. So yeah, sure, you get great growth and you might get fruit real early off that tree. And yeah, that all seems good. But then 10, 15 years later, you can't figure out why your tree's just constantly diseased and there's problems with it. And then the root rot or something, you know, getting into the little bits of rotting root or, you know, the base of the trunk causes the tree to die completely. You know, so yeah, it's one of those short-term kind of things that everybody does. But, you know, just from being a landscaper and watching how things grow and kind of working with things over the years. And again, talking to the old people, you know, I figured all this stuff out that way better to, you know, plant 50 trees. And this is the other thing that I teach about trees in particular is trees are these magical beings that they kind of alchemize the land. I mean, all the plants do this. But trees are very picky about where they want to be. It's why they have so many seeds, right? Is it's a kind of a shotgun approach in nature that the seeds fall everywhere and the trees just grow where they want to be. So there's certain times in certain places where you can put a tree and it will not grow. And it could be because there's a big rock about 5 feet down, or there's a water aquifer, or maybe a whole myriad of different reasons that we don't even know about yet. But trees, as opposed to annual crops, are very fussy that way. So this has kind of been my approach with trees. And, you know, I do have the luxury of having space, which somebody with a little yard might not be able to do this. But rather than, you know, what I say in the book is rather than spending $50 on a big tree and digging a $50 hole, which is to say a big hole and filling it with additives and nutrients and all that stuff, you're better to just plant 50 trees, just like a tree planter. Like you just make a hole in the ground, slip in the roots in the right way, kick it back closed, and that's it. You know, and the reason you do that as opposed to starting seed is because generally if you're bringing in a domestic plant of any kind or something that doesn't already grow there, the native plants are going to go faster and stronger than it. So in the case of, say, a fruit tree or something like that, I generally start with stuff that's a year or two old. And I grow them in my garden for that year or two so that they get to a certain size and development, and then that way they can compete. But that's it. I never touch them again. Like, once they're growing, and then maybe around year 10 when they start to produce, I start giving them a little bit more. So maybe I give them a bit of a ash sprinkling or a lime sprinkling, a bit of mineral, which again is replicating the fire cycle on the earth. Maybe I put a screen around their trunk because suddenly I'm feeling a little possessive and I don't want the mice or the beavers or the porcupines to come along and ring the tree and kill it. But again, it's a co-evolving, co-relationship, and I'm watching how she's doing and she's watching how I'm doing. And, you know, when we get to a certain point in the relationship, I am going to protect her more, but mm-hmm. not right from the start. It's like from the start, you know, I put her out into nature, and it seems like such a backward thing to us. But if you look at indigenous culture, they did this with everything. They even did it with their children. Lots of different traditions involve putting babies outside for a day or two or even longer when they were born. And if they would survive, they knew they were good stock.
Right? Hardening.
There to protect them.
Some of the things you mentioned, I should say, you have two books out. One is Sacred Gardening, Seeds for the Reemergence of Co-Creative Agriculture, which has a lot of philosophy, but some also practical knowledge. But your real practical book is The Story of the Madawaska Forest Garden, Co-Creating Integrated Polyculture. And you mention the use of ash as replicating burns and things like that. One thing I wanted to mention, something that I think is becoming common knowledge now, the scholarship for it is only like 20 years old, is just how sophisticated scholarship, as in Western understanding of the indigenous cultures, knew this for a long time, but they didn't realize how sophisticated indigenous culture was in managing the land. I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the word managing. You can correct me on that. When the first colonists arrived, they thought they were looking at this pristine wilderness that was just bursting with life and food, and they couldn't put their feet in water without stepping on fish. And they were just amazed at this Eden, and they thought, who are these bums living here? We need to take this from them. I wonder if you could comment on sort of this complete lack of comprehension as to how sophisticated to our eyes the indigenous cultures were.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think it's such a complex psychological thing because, of course, when we came to this continent, Europeans, we discovered ourselves, but we discovered a self that we rejected, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. And not only had rejected, but had pounded into the ground, had rejected in such a way because, of course, our indigenosity, the indigenous beings within us all, because we're all indigenous for hundreds of thousands of years. So this illusion that there's some people indigenous and some people aren't is completely wrong. We're all indigenous beings, just some people lost it earlier and some lost it later. So it's very, very threatening, the indigenous way of things to us on a psychological level that I'm quite sure early Europeans to this continent had no concept of. Now we might be able to intellectually grapple with it, but let's face it, we're all still the products of colonization, and that's where we have to start. We can't have some delusion that because we've read a design book or something like that, we know how to work with the earth, or because we know how to hunt or something, we know how to work with the earth. That doesn't mean anything. It's the way that you see things and approach things from the very beginning, and we're backwards. So almost guaranteed, the way you're approaching things is directly related to your colonial legacy, whether it's hunting or permaculture or whatever. And you have to see the truth of that before you can start to actually get someplace with any of this stuff.
There's a quote in your book, Sacred Gardening, I'd like to give. I think the spirits of our ancestors, housed in our bodies and minds, have their own battle dance going on. Like the wolves, but more complicated, like the Bhagavad Gita. We are all part of this epic inner battle, and whether we like it or not, there are no pacifists or bystanders. The only choice we have in this inner war is to be a fearless warrior or to be a coward. So I'm wondering, here we are colonists and we're trying to reclaim our indigenosity. It is an epic. I wonder if you could comment on the spiritual dimensions of this battle. This is just not an internal battle. This spans generations. This spans culture.
Oh yeah. And it's big, you know, and this is the thing is that just like the people in North America, the indigenous First Nations people here, that part of ourself has been suppressed, diminished, poisoned, diseased, knocked down, locked up for, well, you know, 400 years down there and a few hundred years up here. So when that being starts to come out, they're not going to be happy to see you. You get it? Like, we're not a happy sight for nature, right? Mm. With all our internal chatter and the way we go about things, pretty much nothing could be more horrific or antithetical to this reality, the indigenous reality. So just like when you're working with a wild animal, I have a friend, Douglas, down in the States there, and he talked about feeding the deer. And he said every day he goes out to feed the deer and he throws out the corn. And the big thing is to not look at them. You just make your offerings, but you do not stare at them. You do not look at them. You do not take them with that part of your mind. You acknowledge them in the fullness of their being and you keep them in your peripheral vision. And so this is the whole thing, is the way we focus in on things is aggressive and violent in itself.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So the spirits are just like that, right?
Yeah.
The spirits are just like those deers, in case you didn't get the metaphor.
Yes, yes.
You know, we have to make our offerings, but don't be staring at them, right? Don't expect them to do backflips for you just because you fed them once or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it takes years and years for them to get used to you, just like those deer, right?
Yeah, yeah. So now I'm wondering how you, if you can expand on that, how we are meant or how we need to go into nature and start to do the things that you did, like the Madawaska Forest Garden. And I'd like to wrap into this question the whole concept of what appropriation is. My one example of appropriation is pharmaceutical companies going down into indigenous regions with their ethnobotanists saying, what drugs do you use down here? Sometimes they bother to ask them, how do they find this out? Well, they talked to nature. They say, haha, that's really cute. Just give us the drugs so we can go chemically synthesize those and make billions of dollars. That to me is an example of appropriation. The indigenous tribes that came up with this knowledge that used this knowledge, it was a completely different relationship with nature than this kind of like this appropriating culture. And I wonder, if you could talk a little bit about appropriation, what that word means to you, and a proper relationship with nature.
Well, let's maybe start with the first part of the question. So before we get to the appropriation thing,
mm-hmm.
I think the reason why I really have the insights I do, and I do say this in the book, is because I learned how to forage before I learned how to garden.
Ah.
So in this sense, I was much closer to the reality of the land here by learning how to forage. And the idea of gardening suddenly, even in organic gardening, which was the first way that I learned how to garden, seems extremely violent. And again, I've used this word before, but fascist, for lack of a better word, maybe, where you just want to control everything because of your ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, that's kind of one thing. Now, the appropriation thing, this whole thing is just fraught with complications and subtleties. And, you know, in a way, it's too big of a topic to give a quick answer to, but just let me say a few things here. Years and years ago, I went down to Toronto to buy a djembe. So this is an African drum. And it just so happened that there was this man, Siko, who ran this shop. And he got his drums directly from Africa. He's from Africa. Everyone who works there was from Africa. And it was a real community thing. And this beautiful thing happened, which is he wouldn't just sell me the drum. He wanted me to play it. And he wanted to play with me. And he wanted to give me something. And, you know, what actually ended up happening is I ended up making my own drum, because what he made me realize is just borrowing the drum is appropriation. So, yeah, it's appropriation for the pharmaceutical companies to go down there and make it into chemicals. It's also appropriation for us to go down there and just use the herbs ourselves. That's appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, there's tons of gradients and subtleties in this, but again, everybody's like, oh my God, that's native appropriation. And right now it's a real hot thing and people are super knee-jerk reaction about it. And then they go off to their yoga class or to play their djembes or whatever. Like, wake up, people. It's all appropriation. Life is appropriation.
They're completely immersed in a dominant culture that is all about appropriation, and yet they seem to be hypersensitive about certain things being appropriated. And one thing that just occurred to me when you were talking is that the implication of appropriation is that there's some sort of ownership. So does somebody own something? And if they own it, then you appropriate it. And maybe the way to look at appropriation is, well, who owns anything? Who are the owners of anything?
Yeah, for sure. I think I've told a story recently, maybe a couple times, but I'll tell it again, which is that when I was getting my MA, I was using drumming. And by the way, this was the drum that I made. Using drumming as a way to research, I was using it to go inside myself to figure out where the origins of my knowledge came from and the things that I knew. And of course, when my thesis supervisor and the other people on my committee found this out, they weren't too happy about it. They pretty much immediately said, not because it wasn't academic, but because they saw it as appropriation. So I happened to have a friend at the time, an elder from Akasasne, and, I got him on my committee so he could come to the university, and it means he gets paid a little something for that too. So, and he came and he said, no, drumming is a human thing. It's not a native thing. Like all these different cultures, and he actually knew the names of the different cultures, had a different word for exactly what I was doing, which was retrieving information through using this tool of drumming, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then of course they were fine with it, and that's kind of the end of that story. Uh-huh. But it just to say, there is a lot of gradients there. And we have to all watch ourselves. And you know, if you work with native people on this land, on Turtle Island, what you'll find is that they almost all do the pipe ceremony and they almost all do the sweat lodge. But you know, very few people, native tribes, did those things pre-colonial. Mm. Very small percentage of the native people on this continent did those two rituals. Right?
Interesting.
So what am I telling you here? I'm telling you that everybody appropriates things and it's okay. And to get to your other point, which is a big one and a good one, that these things are not owned by the culture that is necessarily identified with it. These things, you know, like the pipe ceremony came from a white buffalo woman. It came from a spiritual being. So it lives in the land. The male and the female part of the pipe, all of this has deep, deep resonance.
Yeah.
And they exist outside that ritual itself. And so if somebody discovers it and then somebody else has a vision of it and sees it and can take it on from an internal way, so it's not mimicking. And from the outside, it might look the same. That's the confusing part, is who's to say what's appropriation, what's the appropriate appropriation, and what's inappropriate appropriation, right?
Well, I mean, appropriation is again, it's a word, it's a label. We talked about naming things, and then there's some implication tied up with it being bad, for example. So it's just a word. Appropriation is just a word that in a sense almost takes our own agency away, our own power away. Hey, I'm my own agent in this world. I get to choose what I can do. I can listen to you and be receptive to your ideas, but you can't tell me that I have no position to have an opinion about something, whether it's how I'm using something or whether I have an opinion about something.
Oh, for sure. And the amazing thing is it can work for you. So something like yoga, or for me, many years ago, when I considered myself a Buddhist, I had people say to me, you can't be a Buddhist because you're not from that culture. You didn't grow up with it. This is something you've taken on. And, you know, of course, at the time I was, you know, 19 or something, I was deeply, deeply offended and argued with the person vehemently. And in a certain way, like now I would kind of understand a bit more what they were saying, but I would also say, listen, the proof's in the pudding, my friend. If you can actually do these things in an integrated way and they're going to help you and change your life, then hey, you know, like it's a real thing and you can do it. It's fine. And of course, you know, again, bowing down to Mr. Kingsley there, he wrote this absolutely brilliant book that links Buddhism with Mongolian shamanism. And of course, Mongolian shamanism is the founding of North American shamanism as well. So the relationship between shamanism and Buddhism is very, very clear, you know, but at the time I didn't know that either.
Mm-hmm. This brings to mind something I remember reading some time ago. I was reading a book on copyrights and, you know, there's a word in our language, genius. A person has a particular genius. Genius comes from genie, which comes from the spirit. And the idea originally with the whole idea of genius is that an artist isn't the owner of a creation. A god passes through the artist. A genius passes through the artist and gets created into the world. It was the lawyers that needed to make money off of things that turned that word genius into something that resides inside my head.
That's really beautiful. I mean, I love that. I heard it years ago, but I've forgotten that one, and it's a good one because we all know it's the truth. If you're an artist or if you're a musician or if you're a poet, you know, they used to call it the muse as well, right? It was your muse that was coming through you. So it's just so clear, right? Like over and over, over again, our whole task is to just get out of the way, you know? But instead we think everything has to be done in this very pragmatic, active and in aggressive kind of way, but in reality, the genius can only come through when you are out of the way, right? Yeah. It's like this idea. There's this, you know, Buddhist saying that even though everybody has, you know, their 5,000 lifetimes coming and then will become the Buddha, we all will become the Buddha at some point as we evolve far enough along the line. But the other piece of that is you will never be the Buddha. Because when you are the Buddha, you will not be you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have one last question for you before we wrap it up. I could continue talking to you for a long time. You're going to be coming and visiting Shepherdstown on February 20th, and you're going to be talking at Sacred Roots Herbal Sanctuary, a medicinal herb farm that my wife and I run. And I wonder what you're going to talk about.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, by the way, Kier. That's great. I never know what I'm going to be talking about, to tell you the truth. I can talk about a lot of different things, as you might have kind of gathered. And so I like feeling what's in the air and what's in people's hearts who are in the room and what their ancestors want to hear. And that's kind of what I go by.
Amen. You know?
And what I've found is that the more I plan the talk, the more boring it's going to be. And, you know, whenever anybody says PowerPoint, that's when I leave the room, right? It's like, okay.
Oh, you're not going to be bringing a PowerPoint presentation with you?
No, I think I'm good with that.
Well, yeah.
You won't need any special equipment.
Well, I think one of the things that I neglected in our interview was some of the practical aspects, particularly that came out of the Madawaska Garden book, the story of the Madawaska Forest Garden, that there are a lot of I hate to say practical, but there's a lot of insight into how you learned to make this a thriving garden. And that's the other half of the story that you tell through your two books. So I guess we'll just have to see what the ancestors are saying when you come down, whether you're going to be doing more of a sort of a spiritual discussion, philosophical discussion like we did, or if we're going to be talking about techniques and possibly adapting them to the local terrain. But I, you know, my own interest in interviewing you was to sort of like explore the underpinnings of this, because I didn't want to talk about a laundry list of techniques. There's a larger context in which this came from.
Yeah, well, bravo for you, you know, and I generally, the way I kind of see this is our culture is so kind of technically and mechanically inclined that it's kind of like a downhill grade when you're talking about stuff. You can go there so easy, and then once you're down there, it's very hard to go back uphill and talk about that other stuff. So I very much appreciate the fact that you had some good questions that really give us the bigger picture. I'm also going to be in Virginia, Crozet, at a Montfair resort. And that's going to be a 2-day practical hands-on workshop where we're helping to begin the transformation of somebody's land there. So just to say, if there's folks listening who are very, very interested in the practical, there'll be a real once-in-a-lifetime opportunity there to have that visit with me and those folks at Montfair.
Excellent.
So I'm looking forward to both visits a lot. And we're back down to minus 20 outside, so I'm really, really looking forward to it.
We're in shirt sleeve weather here. We're in the high 50s right now.
Oh yeah, that's like my house inside. But you know, it's almost spring when I'm there, right?
Oh,
like maybe the first little flowers on the soft maples or something are starting to come out.
Well, I think we're going to be headed for more cold weather before we're out of winter. So I hope that they withhold those buds for a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I'll definitely, when I put up the podcast, I will mention your touring schedule. I'll put that in as well. What is the date for your trip to Crozet, Virginia?
You know, I'm not actually great with the dates.
Don't worry about that.
I'll
do the research. I'll put that up with the podcast.
Let's see if I can conjure it up. I think it's the 23rd.
Okay.
it's right after your place, right?
Yeah, I'll fact check that, and I'll make sure that's part of when I put up the podcast. I'll also mention I'll send the podcast down to them, and they can also use it as a tool to attract people in to see you in person.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. And I'm talking in Brooklyn, and I'm talking in Plattsburgh, in New York, upstate. Hmm. And I think that's about it at this point on the tour.
So far, four. I will, when I put this up, I'll put it as a description, your entire schedule, so that while you're down here in the States, in the warm region, there will be opportunities to meet you in person and ask questions. So I'll definitely...
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, definitely put that up so that people have an opportunity, best opportunity to meet you.
Thank you.
Great. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Stephen. I look so forward to meeting you in person and experiencing your knowledge, your lore, your wisdom firsthand.
Great, man. You too. Thank you so much. And you know, blessings, and have a good day. Breathe some nice air down there for me, and give a tree a pat, and you know, let nature know everything's okay.
I'm going to go out after we are done talking and have a little conversation with a pine tree.
Right on.
All right. Blessings, Stephen, and safe travels.
Okay. See you soon, man.
Thank you for joining us for this 2-part interview with Stephen Martin. This and other podcasts can be found at theredpath.org, where you can also find my Patreon link. If you'd like to make a one-time or recurring donation on Patreon to help me continue, well, that would be encouraging. Thank you all for listening. This is Keir Knoll on The Red Path.